Hello, and welcome to Medium Cool, a movie podcast. I'm your host, Austin Glidden, and as always, you can find us on social media by searching Medium Cool Pod on Instagram. You can also email us at mediumcoolpod@gmail.com. Today is a special day because Matthew Soucy and I are going to be discussing the amazing career of the now, unfortunately, late Donald Sutherland, who died on June 20th, 2024. And I wasn't able to do, I already had the episode for the show immediately after his death, just kind of in the can and ready. So I went ahead and held off until this episode. So we're going to talk for about an hour, 50 minutes or so, just about Donald Sutherland. We pick out a handful of movies based on our own criteria just to kind of encourage people to check out, whether they're good or just notable for any particular reason, or even if the movie's not great, but we're like, God damn, is he great in this movie? You know, that kind of stuff. So we talk quite a bit about it. Matthew Soucy, of course, has tons of input and knows tons of trivia and all that stuff about Donald Sutherland, and I sit there like a complete pleb the whole time, but it's fine. No, not really. Just check that out. I'm looking forward to you hearing this. I had a great time talking with Matthew Soucy about this. Definitely go check out Film Sociology. This is Matthew Soucy's radio show. You can also check it out online, so like on demand, so to speak. So definitely go check out Film Sociology. He'll have a chance to pitch that at the end of the show as well. Also, I wanted to make sure that I touched base. I didn't really feel, quite frankly, like doing full reviews. If you are interested in hearing my full thoughts on any of the movies I'm about to talk about, I will in a heartbeat do them. But just for the sake of brevity, and since I have already a decently, basically a full episode talking with Matthew, I just wanted to talk about three movies that I saw in the last week or so. I saw The Bike Riders by Mike Nichols. I saw Horizon, an American Saga Chapter 1 by Kevin Costner. And then I saw Ty West's new film, kind of rounding out a trilogy of these horror films called Maxine. And I just wanted to give just a few quick thoughts here, not actual reviews. Again, if you want my full thoughts, or if you're like, dude, why do you feel that way? I will do a whole review on it. But again, just for the sake of brevity, I just wanted to make sure I mentioned something about these. So I've been a big fan of Mike Nichols since he made, I think Take Shelter. Yeah, Take Shelter was the first film I'd seen by him. I hadn't seen Shotgun Stories yet. I have since. And actually, the only film I haven't seen of his, I'm looking at his filmography right now. I realize I never watched Loving. I need to check that out. But Take Shelter was a five-star experience to me. I was ready to put this in my, you know, probably like, easy top 50, maybe top 30 films of all time. I mean, I loved Take Shelter when that movie came out. It came out in 2011, and I saw it in 2012, probably. So I am a huge fan of Take Shelter. I haven't seen it in several years now, as Matthew Soucy, speaking of the guest today. He said something that stuck with me ever since. You know, hey, if there are movies that you really love, or movies that you feel like you could get something out of, or maybe you didn't get anything out of before, you know, every 5 or 10 years, give it a rewatch. See if it hits you different, right? And this is a movie I would love to rewatch, see if it holds up. But I adored that. And then Mud, the year of Matthew McConaughey, that is 2012 into that, well, 2013 really, because I think Mud actually was released in 2013, if I'm not mistaken. But either way, though, this movie was my favorite film of that year. Now, if I were to go back, would it still be? Not sure. I need to rewatch Mud, and I'd love to watch more 2013 movies. But Mud, I absolutely adored. Now, Shotgun Stories is great. Not as good as those two, in my opinion. Midnight Special was meh. You know, not great, but I didn't like hate. Actually, I'm looking at my rating. I gave it a 4 out of 5. Maybe I liked this more than I thought, or maybe I just love Jeff Nichols. I don't know. I saw this back in 2016 when it was released. Obviously, I need to rewatch it. I saw my rating. I was like, wow, maybe my memory is just telling me that this wasn't as good as I actually thought it was. So, clearly I need to rewatch Midnight Special. I don't really remember that movie. I didn't find it to be very memorable, at least in my memory. But seeing my feedback on it at the time, apparently I liked it more than I remember. So something I want to check out. The point in saying all of this is, as I ramble on here, is that Jeff Nichols is a guy that I really respect. Regardless of how I feel about some of his movies and how much I love others, I always want to go see his movies. I always go into them with an open mind, trying to just see what I can get out of it. I think he is a skilled director, and I really love his work. Now, The Bike Riders is very interesting because The Bike Riders is a movie that I had a really good time during. I gave it a 3.5 out of 5. There wasn't a moment I wasn't entertained by this movie. You know, it is a heavily entertaining movie. However, unlike other Jeff Nichols movies like Mud and Take Shelter, where I think there's actually a lot of, there's like a lot of nuance. There's a lot of, the performances are great. The story is compelling. What's happening with the characters and how people function in life is just compelling to me. This movie felt like, not literally, well, actually, let me put it this way. It's like when David O. Russell, I'm going to probably fuck this up because I'm already forgetting if he did this movie. Let me look it up here. American Hustle comes out, right? David O. Russell. I had it right. So David O. Russell does American Hustle in 2013. And American Hustle feels like the low rent district Scorsese. You know what I mean? Like Casino and Goodfellas and that style of movie that Scorsese is fucking phenomenal at. Even around the same time the same year actually, he makes The Wolf of Wall Street, which is like a billion times better movie than American Hustle. But American Hustle was entertaining as fuck. It was just like Scorsese light to me, you know, competently made, ridiculous wigs, which I actually loved. Performances were good. It was probably one of my favorite David O. Russell movies up to that point, because I wasn't a huge fan of some of the others that some love, like Joe really loves Silver Linings Playbook. I didn't hate it at all. I was on the like side of that movie. I was positive on it, but I just wasn't blown away by it. It's a movie I need to rewatch. All that said, The Bike Riders feels like a more distant version, but kind of like a Scorsese light to me. Not literally, though. I don't think this actually feels like a Scorsese clone or something like American Hustle really did, in my opinion. But I say that because everyone's kind of a character. Watch Goodfellas. Like, every fucking person in that movie is like a character, you know? It's pretty fast paced. There's great music that kind of stands out, but not in a bad way, in like just an excellent, perfect way. Bike Riders is very much like that. I mean, it just moves quick. Everyone's just a fucking character. It just feels kind of Scorsese light to me. And all that said, I really enjoyed The Bike Riders. It's just, I think it is a relatively shallow film. It's just covering something that is interesting enough, and you follow some characters through some hard stuff, like hard story beats and stuff. It's pretty cool. So a lot of people not as big on this as I was. Again, it's mostly just entertaining. Like, I found it pretty good. I think it really does struggle with some of the writing. I think the pacing's fine, but I think the characters and things could be a bit more dimensional, make us care a little more. We have Jodie Comer's character who plays this kind of North Midwestern, kind of North Dakota accent almost, you know. And she's just kind of like character that makes you smile, but also you can kind of take seriously throughout the film. She has a great performance and has some really great scenes, so I want to give her props. She never really feels grounded to me. She really feels like a character, you know. Half the time, there are things going on, and we're just kind of watching it happen. I don't really feel like things have been developed enough to give them any more weight than they inherently have. I think Tom Hardy is getting a lot of shit for his accent. Not that he does a bad accent. It's just like a very Tom Hardy thing to do, I guess, maybe. I like him in this a lot. I love Tom Hardy just in general. I just think every movie I see him in, he is a highlight. I even like Bane. So yeah, he's cool. And then, you know, Austin Butler does very well also. So this is a movie I'd tell you to check out. It's not going to blow your mind, but, you know, maybe you'll have a good time with it. So that is The Bike Riders. I also was able to see Horizon, an American Saga. And this is a bizarre movie for me because this is a 3-hour epic, essentially, of a Western. And I'll tell you exactly what I thought about halfway through. I'm like, this movie's trying really fucking hard to be the Western version of Lord of the Rings. Like, it's jumping around to so many characters. The area that it fails at doing that, and I'm not saying that's one of its goals, and I'm not saying everyone's going to agree with that statement, but that's just, I'm just saying that's what came to my mind, right? Whether it's accurate or not doesn't matter. And so this movie, I think the writing is really my problem with it, because this feels like a TV miniseries that they just took the first 3 episodes and put it into a movie. And then the chapter 2 that comes out in August is just going to be episodes 4-6. And then when they make the other 2, it's just going to end up being a full length miniseries. And I think that's what it should have ended up being, in my opinion. That's not to say that I don't like it. I gave this a 2.5 because, quite frankly, the rating split down the middle, 2.5 out of 5, is exactly how I was on this movie. The first half of it, so much shit happens, and I'm going to say just off the bat, not a lot of weight behind it, other than what's like inherently there from the context of the scene. But I think certain things could be developed better. I think certain performances could be better. I think the music makes the film feel way too saccharine. It's just too, it's just fucking, I can't even think of the word I'm looking for, but it's just thick, sweet honey. You know what I mean? Like, I can't think of the word that starts with an M for some reason. But anyways, but it's that thing. It's just saccharine, you know? It's just so trying to show you how much it loves Westerns while also trying to make you feel sad for certain people that are being either oppressed or attacked or murdered. And because it tries so hard, it ends up kind of leaving me wanting more. Jenna Malone, funny enough, I used to love her in like indie movies when she was a lot, like, you know, a teenager and early 20s. And then she started doing these wacky movies and became like, her performances felt like she was trying to be an actress rather than just like acting. And she's trying really hard. And in this movie, it's sad because she's done that for so many years that I can feel that in this, but she actually does really well, I think. Like, I actually think, like, she's pretty good. Michael Rooker is in this, and I love Michael Rooker. Why does he have a fucking Irish accent? It's not great, in my opinion. I mean, maybe it is super accurate, but it stands out like a sore thumb to me. I'm like, why just either make him his voice or put a fucking Irishman in there? You know what I mean? Like, what's happening? These are nitpicks, but Giovanna Ribisi is kind of shown for a second. He's marked for being in the film, you know, credited, but he's not really in this movie. He'll be in the second one, I'm sure. But Koster puts on a great performance, I thought. Sam Worthington's fine. Sienna Miller's really good. It's just kind of all over the place. Some of the performances are good. Most of them, quite frankly, are fine. They're like side characters in a TV show. If that makes any sense to you, it does to me. So there are a lot of set pieces and things that happen in the film. My buddy that I saw it with and I, we stood outside the movie and there were only 2 sequences that stood out to me. And whenever I think of these movies, I think of things like, take something like Reservoir Dogs. There are so many scenes that just stand out in that really are kind of staples in the film. The scene around the diner table, like the diner sequence, basically, where all of the heist men are sitting there talking, and you have the Madonna and the big dicks and you have the tips and all that. I mean, the dialogue's so good. Take something like or the torture scene in Reservoir Dogs, which is a staple scene regardless of whether you like it or not, right? Another great sequence is in, there are a couple of great ones in Inglourious Basterds. We actually get 2 phenomenal sequences. One is the opening sequence with the French farmer. The other is in the German bar with Van Hammersmark and Michael Fassbender's character and you know, all those sequences are unbelievable, and they're all dialogue, right? But the tension is so palpable. It's so good. You could name a lot of sequences like this in Tarantino movies, for example. There are so many. There are too many to name in like Pulp Fiction, something like the adrenaline to the heart, even Django Unchained with the Leonardo DiCaprio with the skull of an African-American, you know, and he's talking about the dimple. That scene is so intense because, you know, these characters know things that other characters don't, and it's really intense. So all that to say, like, Horizon has no hook to me. It has no, like, strong scene. You're just kind of watching a story play out. And I think it really needs a scene. I think it needs something to really hook you, that one sequence that's going to pull you in. I also think it needs a more focused story. We have three fucking story arcs happening right now. Now, you could say in Lord of the Rings that there are multiple story arcs happening, and that's true. However, if you watch it, the Fellowship of the Ring is almost exclusively focused on Frodo, the Fellowship, and getting that ring to Mordor to be destroyed, right? The very end, Sam and Frodo go off in the boat. Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli go off on their thing, and then, you know, there's another story that I'm for some. Oh, the other two hobbits, right? So there are three stories kind of going on, because the other hobbits, I believe, get taken. If they don't get taken there, they get taken at another point. But the point is, I just need to. I'm off the top of my head here. All right, but the point is, like, it's focused. It gives you that. It allows you to care for certain characters or to get some context before it goes off. This movie just starts with boom. We have three threads going. Done. I just feel like you really should have hooked us. I feel like this should have started more simply, and then you can start to branch it off in future chapters. But give us a chance in this chapter to really kind of acclimate to what we're seeing and get some more context there. I just didn't think this was developed well. I don't dislike the movie, though. I will admit there are two sequences, going back to the Tarantino comparison I said, which this is nothing like a Tarantino movie. Let me clarify. But there is a great sequence with one of the baddies and Kevin Costner as they're walking up to meet a prostitute at a home. That sequence is really, I think, comparatively to the rest of the film, it's very well done. like it is one of the standout sequences. And see, I'm already forgetting the other one off the top of my head. That's what I'm saying. This movie doesn't have a lot of notable things in it. It just is fine. And you can also kind of see that in, at least on Letterboxd and stuff, in the skew where it's all right kind of in the center. It's like people are kind of in the middle around that 3-star area. I think 3 stars is fine too. I kind of rounded down a bit. This is probably the highest 2.5 on my list if I had to guess. But 2.5 out of 5 is what I gave Horizon American Saga. I am interested in seeing Chapter 2. And this movie is also weird because the last 5 minutes of it is essentially, I mean, when I say essentially, I mean, it is literally a trailer for the next movie, which is weird. Like, a bunch of shit's happening out of nowhere, and you're like, what is going on? And then it's like, Horizon Chapter 2 or whatever. And it's like, oh, shit, they just showed us a trailer for the last few minutes of this movie. So, yeah, it is a weird movie. I was a little underwhelmed by it, unfortunately. But let me know what you think. The last thing I want to talk about is Maxine. I am really eager to talk about this real quick. I have been a fan of Ty West since The House of the Devil. Hit or miss movies, of course. Like, I don't think all of them are as good as that. The House of the Devil is really great. I actually really love X. I like X more than Pearl. I was not a huge fan of Pearl personally, though I think Ty West was doing some really cool stuff in Pearl. I think there are some good sequences in Pearl, but I wasn't like a super fan of that movie. It's fine. Okay. It does, like, there's almost like a technicolor brightness to it that I'm not a big fan, but I like respect the choice there. I mean, man, he was really trying to give this a visual style. There's more kind of storytelling going on here, rather than it just being a genre flick, all of that. Very cool. Mia Goth, great. Okay. So Pearl is good. X, I think, is really great as just kind of a really gritty and grim genre flick, right? It's doing this kind of 70s slasher horror, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, blah, like whatever. And so that is really great. I love X. That is the pinnacle. That and House of the Devil are my easy two favorites. I've actually never seen The Innkeepers. And what is the other movie that he did? The Valley of Violence. In a Valley of Violence, I've actually never seen. So those two I haven't seen yet. I do want to see The Sacrament. I just haven't gotten around to it. But all that said, X is really excellent. Pearl was pretty good. I mean, I gave it a 3.5 out of 5. So, I mean, it's good, but I just I don't look back on it feeling like I need to like rewatch that over anything else. X, I only gave a 4 out of 5, but it's a pretty high 4 for me. I really like X. It's a lot of fun. Maxine is interesting because it directly ties in to X even more so than Pearl. Pearl's almost like a weird kind of prequel tying into it differently, into that kind of universe, so to speak. Maxine goes back to X and is like kind of a direct sequel of that movie taking place years later. And I don't know why people are hating on this movie so much. I'm looking at the ratings and stuff, and it's a lot of between 2 and 3 stars out of 5. And not that ratings mean everything. I mean, you can just like, you know, read what they actually, how they actually feel about this and so on. But dude, the effects and stuff in it look great. The lighting looks great. The music is great. I love the attention to detail in the era that they're depicting, that 80s style. All the songs that they play are not just like hits that we all know to sell a soundtrack. It's like stuff that actually would have been casually playing on a radio station back then. You know, I love the hairdos. I love the performances. I actually think this movie fucking kicks ass. Now, is it like super deep? No, it's pretty shallow and really ridiculous, but I also think it is accurate to the like 80s slasher horror style. I mean, this is very much a Brian De Palma inspired. When you watch it, you can like very much, for me, I see Dress to Kill in this quite a bit. Maybe some, what's the movie called? Body Double as well. Another De Palma film. So like those two things being involved. And then you have something like, you know, there's like a bummer kind of Schrader vibe almost in some ways. Takes something like Hardcore with the porn industry and stuff, you know. But instead of it being some Midwest religious dude's daughter, in this case, it's like a killer killing all these porn stars, basically. So all that said, I think this movie's awesome. That's what I'm getting at. I think this movie's awesome. I think Mia Goth is really great here. I think all of the performances in one degree or another are great in context. Kevin Bacon plays an absolutely ridiculous private investigator, and he's kind of fucking awesome. Like I like this dude. There's a point where you literally see a ball sack and it gets crushed by high heels. And it's like kind of awesome. In the same way that I think slasher movies in the 80s or any other era are awesome. A lot of practical effects going on here, which I think are awesome. It ties into X in kind of a really ridiculous, convoluted way, I would say, at the end. And it makes it kind of, I think that does pull away the sting or the punch a bit. It pulls its punch there, I guess you could say. But all in all, I think Maxine is actually is really good. This is, I would rather watch Maxine over Pearl any day, personally. Again, I think Pearl's probably a better film, but just on personal preference and enjoyment, I think Maxine is great. Is it a little sloppy? Sure. Could the writing be better? Sure. Does it need to be better? No, because I think it fits the genre of what it's depicting really well. Now, does that make the film better? No, but for me on a personal level, I really had a good time with this. And, I thought that, this just deserved more. And I'm really bummed out that a lot of people seem to kind of be pretty lukewarm on this movie. Again, granted, I only gave it a 3.5 out of 5, but that's pretty good for me with modern horror movies. So I'm just a little surprised, if I'm honest. So if you agree or disagree with anything that I've said up to this point, please let me know. I've already talked way too long about these three movies, but I just wanted to share some quick thoughts on them. funny enough, I still took about the length of time for one whole review that I normally do, but I talked about three movies, so I feel like that's a win for me. All that said, let's stop talking about all this other crap. We're going to talk about Donald Sutherland here. Matthew Soucy will join me here in just a moment. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy. And if you agree or disagree with any of these movies, please hit us up, MediumCoolPod on Instagram, or email us at MediumCoolPod@gmail.com. Give me just a second, and I will bring Matthew Soucy in, and we're going to talk about Donald. I'll get it right this time. Donald Sutherland. Donald Sutherland's career in film spans more than five decades, and his impact on the industry is both profound and enduring. Known for his versatility and depth, Sutherland has brought a unique blend of intensity and subtlety to a wide range of characters across various genres, making him one of the most reliable and compelling character actors in Hollywood. From his early days, Sutherland demonstrated a willingness to take on diverse and challenging roles. His performance as the rebellious Hawkeye Pierce in MASH from 1970 showcased his ability to blend humor with a poignant anti-establishment ethos, setting the tone for many of his future roles. This was followed by memorable turns like Clute from 1971, where he portrayed the enigmatic John Clute, and Don't Look Now from 1973, which remains a staple in psychological horror. Throughout his career, Sutherland collaborated with some of the industry's most esteemed directors, including Robert Altman, Federico Fellini, and Bernardo Bertolucci, to name very few. These collaborations resulted in critically acclaimed films that are now considered classics by many cinephiles, highlighting his ability to adapt to various directorial styles and cinematic visions. And unlike many of his contemporaries, Sutherland often chose character roles over leading man status, exploring the darker and more complex aspects of human nature. The choice cemented him and his reputation as a dedicated and skilled actor who could bring authenticity and depth to any role. Whether it was the chilling portrayal of President Snow in the Hunger Games series, which I'm not a huge fan of, but he's great, or the nuanced performances in films like Ordinary People from 1980 or Pride and Prejudice from 2005. Sutherland's longevity in the industry is a testament to his talent and adaptability. He has remained relevant by continuously taking on new and challenging roles, demonstrating an unwavering commitment to his craft. Despite being often overlooked by major awards, his work has not gone unnoticed. In 2017, he received an honorary Academy Award for his contributions in the film industry, underscoring the respect he commands within the industry and the lasting impact of his career. Moreover, Sutherland's influence extends beyond his own body of work. His dedication to acting has made him a role model for aspiring actors, and his legacy is carried on through his son, Kiefer Sutherland, who has also enjoyed some success as well. In retrospect, Donald Sutherland's life in film is marked by a consistent pursuit of challenging and diverse roles, fruitful collaborations with top directors, and an unwavering dedication to his craft. His career is a testament to the power of character acting and the importance of versatility and commitment in the ever-evolving landscape of cinema. Now, Donald Sutherland is a person that, admittedly, Matt, I was surprised at how many movies I hadn't seen that he is involved in. When I was looking through his IMDb after he had passed, I realized that I am more of an auteurist than I thought. I say that because most of the films that I've seen that he's in, I had been watching films by that director and just so happened to watch it, Robert Altman being an example. Mm-hmm. I'm losing it. Clute.
Alan Pakula.
Yeah. Pakula. I was watching a bunch of his films from that era, things like that. Or it was genre-based, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers with horror movies.
Yeah.
You know, that's the reason that I saw that. So I found that I have a lot of blind spots, and I have a feeling you may have some of these on your list. I'd love to hear what you think. But before we get to kind of talking about five movies, and for listeners, we're not doing like a top five. This isn't like – actually, I don't have a clue what Matt's list is. But for me
because Austin knows how I feel about lists more than once a year.
Yeah, this is not meant to be any kind of hierarchical list or any kind of thing. It's just, hey, here are five movies that he's in. And I want to talk a little bit about like his impact on them, but also check these movies out. You know, that's kind of where I came from.
Well, first off, I know it's just audio, but I'm also wearing my Detroit Tigers t-shirt out of respect because he was a diehard Montreal Expos fan, serious baseball guy. And the fact that we're recording this on Canada Day, I know you planned this, Austin. Great timing.
Oh, of course. Of course. Yeah, of course I did.
Well, as I was going to say, I was going to counter your question with a question, but I was going to start with, I think everyone's path with an artist, obviously is very different. I was going to ask, what was your first Sutherland experience that you can remember?
Oh, boy. I'm actually going to have to, I'm looking at his IMDb as well.
Okay, you do that. I'll give you mine. Because I went to a lot of stuff with my folks in the 70s. I think the first thing I saw him in was Animal House as a professor. Hilarious. Because he finds Milton as boring as you find Milton. And he's not joking. This is his job. In the early incarnations, before there was HBO in Michigan, we had a movie channel called Channel 100. They played Invasion of the Body Snatchers constantly. Think about this. He's forever on social media. He will always be on this contraption because of the final scene in Body Snatchers, which is a Hall of Fame gif. Always. Yeah. And by the way, because that was rated PG, even though we get full frontal Brooke Adams and some other stuff, but to see that in the daytime for a scary movie, man, that's a wow. I also saw him in, and if folks, you need to look for this. He had a cameo as the clumsy waiter in the That's Armageddon trailer in the comedy film Kentucky Fried Movie. He worked with Landis twice. And this is a great example of he was already a name actor. This film came out in 1975. He does one scene where he falls onto a cake. Yep. That's it. Then there was Body Snatcher. And then when I was 10, I saw Ordinary People. So that's a path. That's a hell of a start with this guy. And he is a man who I literally grew up watching from when I was a young movie nerd.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, like Ordinary People, like I have not gone through a binge on Let's Watch Redford movies. You know what I'm saying? I would love to. Yeah.
Director.
Yeah. It's just when you run a podcast and you want to watch everything, it's fucking hard. Okay.
So I know the struggle is real.
Because on the Criterion channel right now, and I've talked about this on the show, I want to do a Paul Schrader marathon because Bummerville, bro. And so like and they have like all a bunch of his movies on there. I'm like, dude, I just gotta start marathoning this. And I just haven't found the time, which is the problem, because I have other things, and especially when people like Donald Sutherland die, it makes it real hard to just move past it.
I know. I want to bring up Ordinary People because what you are with Kubrick, I am with Scorsese. I don't have tattoos of him, but that's my guy. Yeah. That's my guy. And I know for a lot of, and I know if there was I probably would have been a Twitter film bro if we had social media in the 80s. And I thank God that we did not, but Ordinary People is a thorn in some of the sides of Scorsese bros. Not as bad as Dances with Wolves, but I'm here to tell you it's a great example of cinematic apples and oranges. Ordinary People is a great film. It's a great domestic drama. I just so happen to think that Raging Bull is a masterpiece.
Yeah.
It came out
the wrong year. Tough is year. Really what we're talking about.
Yeah, Marty should have 4 best directing Oscars by now, including Raging Bull and The Last Temptation of Christ and Goodfellas. But that's another argument for somewhere else. Everybody talks about, because yes, it won Best Picture. Redford won Best Director. Tim Hutton won Best Supporting Actor. Judd Hirsch was nominated. Mary Tyler Moore was nominated. And I think it was Mary Tyler Moore's casting that overshadowed what a big deal it was to cast Sutherland in this. As you mentioned with MASH, he became the counterculture movie star. He was not your conventional leading man. There's a heartbreaking interview with Sutherland when he was interviewed by Anderson Cooper, where he said, as a child, he asked his mother if he was good looking, and her response was, "You have an interesting face, Donald." That's heartbreaking for and you know, Cooper asks, "Does it bother you?" And he goes, 65 years still. And you know, and by the way, he wound up playing Casanova, which hopefully we'll get to in a little bit. But the fact that, you know, he became famous for playing Hawkeye Pierce and doing all these counterculture roles, and then to play the sweater wearing dad who is absolutely torn between trying to appease his very domineering wife and his very fragile son. It's heartbreaking. He's so fucking good in this. Now, the other part is, when people say so-and-so got robbed with the nomination, I'm the guy that says, all right, who do you take out? So here are your nominees for Best Actor in 1980. Robert De Niro in Raging Bull. He won. Yeah.
Rightfully so. I get it.
Rightfully so. Yeah, absolutely. John Hurt in The Elephant Man.
Rightfully so. Nominated.
Peter O'Toole in The Stuntman. Mm-hmm. Love that film. Robert Duvall in The Great Santini. And the one I would take out, no disrespect, is Jack Lemmon in Tribute. Okay. It's a good performance. It's a, you know, it's a funny guy who winds up getting cancer. It's directed by Bob Clark, who, yes, Bob, yes, Christmas Story, Black Christmas, Porky's Bob Clark. and Lemmon has done, he did better that decade. He's done better performances that. So anyway, so that's the answer on that. I wish he did. He didn't. He got an honorary. It's all good. So there's that.
I mean, but the list goes, it just, we could go on and on about not only Sutherland, but all, like, that's just, you're right. That's a difficult, like, that's one of those years where it's like, fuck, you guys had your work cut out for you.
Yeah.
Because I would say for me, just listening, it's like, well, it's obviously, it's De Niro or Hurt to me. And quite frankly, they're both so unreal in those movies to me.
Yeah.
But I do think that De Niro's is more. Yeah, De Niro's might have just more gravitas, and so I get why it won, and I adore Raging Bull.
I love that you use the word adore with Jake LaMotta.
Yeah.
Who couldn't turn it off when he was out of the ring. That adorable Jake LaMotta. Adorable Raging Bull. I know.
Dude, listen to, look who you're talking to. Okay?
I know. Like, just like me. I've been working on the Bummersville reconstruction project because of you. So,
dude, it's real. Let me tell you this, and then I want to jump into just the movies that we want to talk about here. I want to say this. You asked me what the first movie I saw, and I'm almost positive, because it was 1995. I would have been 10. Outbreak. I'm pretty sure Outbreak was the movie that I saw where he plays General Donald McClintock.
But that's directed by Wolfgang Peterson.
Yep.
I don't know if it's aged well, but
I don't. I'm sure it hasn't. But I'm pretty sure I saw this in. I did too. So I didn't see it in theaters. Probably my mom would have never. But I saw this at some point. We must have rented it or something. But I remember this being so horrifying to me. I was like 10, okay? But it was like horrifying.
Right.
Yeah.
So, no, I was 25. So, yeah, I saw that in the theater. But that's another example. We say this a lot, and I think Sutherland's a great example of it. He's always good, even if the material is not.
Yeah,
he knows what needs to be done. To, you know, he's aware he's in a film called The Puppet Masters. He's aware that it's a kind of a knockoff on Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and they've asked him to be in it because he was in Body Snatchers. He's fully aware of all of that.
But it's like The Hunger Games, like I brought that up before, because I actually think he, like, it, regardless of how much I don't like those movies personally, like, he is, no matter what, he commands a certain authority. And he just, his subtlety makes it so much better. Then even if you have like bad sequences and arguably bad film, the script is bad, he's going to fucking sell it the same way. You know, like, I don't know if you've ever listened to WTF with Marc Maron, but you should listen to his episode with Ian McKellen, Sir Ian McKellen. Yes, and sir. Ian McKellen goes off on, out of nowhere, it's the last bit of their interview, and then he just cuts it off. He does a monologue from, I think it's Macbeth or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's fucking unreal because he's so fluent
in
like Shakespearean language that it just sounds natural, and like I'm like listening to it and I'm like almost crying. Like listening to him do it. But Sutherland is similar in that way where he can take kind of anything and he's just commanding.
Yep. I think he's the best thing of about the Hunger Games. There was also before that, he was in a TV series my wife and I watched called Commander in Chief with Gina Davis as the first female president. And he is the Republican adversary. And he just, like Snow, just glides through everything, just makes it look effortless. You bring up President Snow. I have to share this. Also, the fact that, Mr. Counterculture guy becomes a villain in this. So it was like when you saw Robert Redford in Captain America. It's like inspired casting. So I showed my kid MASH when they were a teenager. Now I was 12. I didn't see MASH until I think I was like 12. I was a big fan of the series. Had not gotten around to seeing it because it hadn't been on cable or what have you. And I admit parts of that film have not aged well. Watching it with a teenage kid, and I was like, "Yeah, it's anti-authority," and they go, "Yeah, it's misogynistic as hell, and it's a little racist," and I was like, "Okay, yeah, it's a floor wax and a dessert topping." Okay. So, and I'm showing it to the kid, and it's fun to do this when you have a young film fan, because you do things like, you see Robert Duvall and you're like, that's Boo Radley. Oh yeah, that's Boo Radley. And there's Tom Skerritt, and that's Drum from Steel Magnolias. Yeah, that's right. And then there's Trapper, and it's Monica and Ross's dad from Friends. Yeah. And we're an hour into the film and they haven't figured out Hawkeye yet. They're looking at Sutherland and they said, where do I know him from? And I leaned in and I said, he's the voice on the Orange Juice commercials. Oh yeah. Yeah. And they still weren't getting it. They finally gave up. And I said, that's President Snow. And they just went, oh my God, no way. And I was like, yeah. So another example of watching some, the path that different person takes with an actor. And so I have four subgenres when it comes to Sutherland. I wrote a lead category, which we've already talked about. We've already talked about supporting category, ensemble, which we'll get to in a second, and cameo. The other part I think he's going to be in the GIF Hall of Fame is for playing Oddball in Kelly's Heroes. We saw a lot of the negative waves going on. And here's the other. This is how much we love Donald Sutherland. In that film, he basically plays a hippie in a World War II heist film. Now, I know there are free thinkers in the 40s, not to this level, but it's kind of like the pass we give everyone's favorite Russian submarine commander, Sean Connery, or Dolly Parton in Steel Magnolias. Everybody is from Louisiana except Truvy, whose voice never left Pigeon Forge. It's just, he's so cool, you don't care. It's all right. And he was also in the Dirty Dozen, as I mentioned. But the cameo stuff, I remember the early, growing up in Michigan and seeing the horror shows in Detroit, because his credits, as you mentioned, go back to the early 60s. There's a little scene Italian film called Castle of the Living Dead. He plays three roles in it. He's known as Sergeant Paul, so he's a soldier, the witch, and the old man.
Love that.
And it's just this weird little oddity. We mentioned Kentucky Fried Movie. And then, of course, the moment where he took 16 minutes and grabbed a film by the lapels, Oliver Stone's JFK. Film that has half the Screen Actors Guild in it.
Yep.
But halfway through the film, it's 16 minutes of Costner getting a lesson in exposition by Donald Sutherland. And it's pretty damn impressive.
I want to stop you there real quick, because JFK is actually on my list. And I put this in as almost like a placeholder. Not placeholder, but as a representation of someone who can be in. I mean, how many scenes is he total? He's in like three? Only the one?
One!
See, I feel like I remember like multiple.
No. There's a couple of cutbacks of, black and white footage of, men in uniforms talking about something. Sutherland's just in the one scene.
That's crazy. Yeah, because that shows how your memory can like run with it. Because I knew that he was in it so little, but honestly, and no joke, for half the Screen Actors Guild, as you said, like the crazy cast, one of the people I remember outside of Costner is Sutherland.
Yeah.
And I think that's I think that is just a complete testament to that 16 minutes, as you said.
Tommy Lee Jones got Best Supporting Actor nomination. Sissy Spacek, Matthau and Lemon, not in the same scenes. Joe Pesci with a stupid wig and a Southern accent. Michael Rooker, Laurie Metcalf, everybody. There's so many people in this, but Sutherland absolutely owns it for the minutes he's in it.
100%. Yep. And I actually... And regardless of how one feels about the theory that they're exploring or not, I don't actually give a fuck because that movie is fucking awesome to me.
I said if a fit like a documentary, if a film makes you go out and do the research, whether you want to learn more or you want to tell everybody that the director's full of shit, mission accomplished.
Yeah.
I'm totally down with that.
But also there are some real powerhouse performances in this, not least of them, you know, Sutherland's. I mean, what, like, again, you know, I forgot Pesci was in it. Okay. Like,
right.
And because quite frankly, it's like almost too much of a good thing where there's so many people that, and no one's in it that long. Most of them, you know,
and we get, like I said, the wig, the accent, there's, you know, nobody wants to see the second unit footage of the Clay Shaw party scenes. Nobody. Yeah.
I mean, I forgot Tommy Lee Jones was in this movie. That tells you how much I forgot because it's 3 fucking hours long. And guess who I remembered? Donald Sutherland. And that is, I think, just like the biggest compliment I can give in a movie that has so many powerhouses. This person is the one that actually stuck in my brain. And I found that sequence to be so good.
Yep. Sutherland played Jesus Christ in Johnny Got His Gun.
That's another one on my list, funny enough.
Yes, so and it's not just for Metallica fans anymore. You can watch the film on its own without playing the song One, which, well, seriously, Metallica owes that, or vice versa. That film owes Metallica a great deal of debt for putting footage of their movie in that video.
Well, what's funny is JFK was my placeholder for a scene, like a one scene, or I thought a very few scenes, but still we learn it's one scene where Sutherland steals it. Johnny Got His Gun, I don't think is necessarily even among his best films, but it's another example of the character actor of Sutherland. He's playing this kind of weird Christ figure. And I want to tell people what the movie's about, because funny enough, in rare form for me, I read the book first. So I actually knew the book and didn't even know the movie existed. And then after I read the book, I eventually found out that it did exist, but it has been probably more than 20 years since I've seen it. So in full transparency, I don't really remember a lot of the film.
It's in the J's in my basement.
Yeah. but I do, again, Sutherland, I remember. And like, that's another testament. So real quick, just so everybody knows, Johnny Got His Gun is from 1971. Tells the harrowing story of Joe Bonham, a young American soldier who was severely wounded during World War I. He's trapped in his own body, where Joe loses his limbs, face, and senses, leaving him unable to see, speak, hear, or move. So if you're not getting it already, this is straight to Bummerville.
Darkness envisioning me.
Confined in a hospital bed, he remains conscious and fully aware of his situation. And as he struggles to communicate and come to terms with his condition, Joe reflects on his life, memories, and the devastating consequences of war. And it's based on a Donald Trumbo anti-war novel of the same name, which, Donald again, Trump. I read. And I remember reading it, and that has haunted me. I don't want to detour and just about the film, but this is important. It's haunted me since I read it, because think about this. In the book, it talks a lot about how he can only tell when it's day or night, when he can feel the sun coming through the window and warming his body. And like he can't talk, he's just stuck in his head. He can't hear. He can't really feel much. Like, well, he can feel, but like he can't hear. He can't smell. He can't speak. He can't, you know, like he can't see, none of these things. And it's a horrifying idea. And amidst this movie, you have this kind of symbolic presence and literally Christ. I mean, not actually Jesus,
literally,
but I mean,
figuratively,
like, yeah, I get you.
Timothy Bottoms plays the soldier. Jason Robards plays his father. And yeah, there's Oddball with a cloak. I'm like, oh, it's JC. How you doing?
But he's so fun. He's like so fun, and he's just playing cards with people at one point. He's doing weird card tricks.
For what it's worth, and I don't take it, I love the books, the Golden Turkey Awards. They are fun to read, but Sutherland was nominated for the worst performance of Jesus Christ, but it's from Michael Medved, so take that for what it's worth. Don't.
Maybe I just like Sutherland too. Again, I haven't seen this movie in so long. So if anybody sees this and they're like, that is a lesser Sutherland, that may be true.
But wow. Hear me out.
Well, hold on. That may be true. But here's the thing, though. Out of anyone who likes Sutherland, I feel like this is one of the movies you probably haven't watched. Okay. It's probably in that group. And I think the premise is so interesting to me. And there's a great scene. I encourage anyone to go to YouTube. I've already looked it up and watched it again. But it's again, another Bummerville moment. Like, he's laying in bed and these people are talking about what they're going to do with him in the hospital.
Yeah.
And they're like, what's he been saying? Because I forget what he does. He does, like, fucking Morse code with his head or whatever.
Yeah, starts banging, and he starts doing Morse code.
Yeah. And so and he just keeps saying, like, kill me. Yeah. Kill me. It's like so fucked up, dude. Like, like, that's as why, someone who loves like those bummer movies, this one is like thematically it's as dark as it gets.
The intensive care ward of Bummersville General. But the fact that video came out in 1988. So I'm sorry. Now we're getting into a side tangent on rock history. The fact that Metallica got that video on the airwaves of MTV in the Reagan 80s. Showing footage of this film from the early 70s written by Dalton Trumbo. And yeah, it was pretty very ballsy for its time. No, the minor Sutherland, you say, there's do you know the film The Squid and the Whale?
Of course.
Noah Baumbach. The Squid and the Whale. My kid and I, we love that film, but one of my favorite moments of pop culture debaggery is Jeff Daniels at the dinner table in the opening scene when they're discussing Charles Dickens, and I believe it's Hard Times. And without even looking up, Jeff Daniels goes, "It's minor Dickens." It's such an ass move. It is such a jerk off mood. And we were like, so now we just, it's minor Sutherland.
So. Oh, yeah. 100. Dude, that, I love that movie. And I'm trying not to derail on it right now because that movie rules.
Yes.
But Trumbo, you speak of the Reagan 80s and stuff. That's so true because Trumbo was hit by the Un-American or the House Un-American Activities Committee for being a communist. And like they're, dude, if you get into the whole Johnny Got His Gun backstory, and then you think about, although this is early in Sutherland's like being a notable actor part of his career, this is where he's really establishing that in that early 70s, I think. Mm-hmm. Again, not that he didn't do anything before, but I mean, I think he's becoming a powerhouse in that first half of the decade. And he's in this movie in 1971, written by a communist during a time where they were doing witch hunts. And it is during like Vietnam, right? So he's like, I mean, dude, there, it's just, again, whether the movie is great or not, I don't care. It's more about like the concept is interesting. And Sutherland is just a really fun character that I don't think you're going to see him in another movie.
Speaking of which, to get back to Sutherland, you need to look for, I don't know if it's available on video, it's a concert documentary called FTA from 1972. It was a series of anti-USO shows run by Donald Sutherland and Jane Fonda.
Wow.
Yeah, this was their version of the Bob Hope, USO shows done for the counterculture. And by the way, slight piece of advice. Stay off the internet when Jane Fonda dies.
So, it's going to be a bad time.
It's going to be a really ugly time. So just putting that out there. Anyway, so between MASH playing Christ and doing a documentary about these anti-war rallies, kind of their version of the USO shows, Yeah, this was Sutherland in the early 70s. You know, yeah. It was non-traditional leading men. Him and Elliot Gould. Gould, of course, was another one who became a movie star, became a leading man, which wouldn't have happened in the 50s and 60s. There's another interview, I think, I don't know if it's the same one, but I'm sure Sutherland had his book of stories where he got offered a part in a film. And the director and the producer and every casting all loved him, but they didn't cast him. And he asked why. And they said, well, we're looking for somebody who is the boy next door. And quite honestly, we don't think you live next door to anybody. So that's kind of what that was. So anyway, to go from those, you mentioned Don't Look Now, which I just watched over the weekend. The two films I watched of his, because they were on my pile, I had purchased them and I had not watched, revisited them. One was Don't Look Now.
Literally this whole shelf right here, movies I own and haven't watched yet. Yeah, I got you. Yeah.
I got you. You know. So yeah, him and Julie Christie in the Who Has the Better Hair contest from 1973, directed by Nicholas Roeg, a couple dealing with the death of their daughter in Venice. And it's Nicholas Roeg. So, yeah, they're in a suburb of Bummersville. And then Fellini's Casanova. I had not seen Fellini's Casanova in about probably 30 years. And Fellini wanted to break down, deconstruct the Casanova character. And basically saying, Stupping is not as all as it lives up to be. And he wanted to just make Casanova just a walking penis. I'm paraphrasing on what Mr. Fellini's goal was for the film, but because it's Sutherland and he had to, you know, thin his hair out here, it got a nomination for costumes. It also lost a lot of money from it got picked up by Universal. We forget that in the late 70s, we were talking earlier about every big filmmaker had one big financial failure that kind of crippled the directors having power, and it became a corporate-run movie studio, and that's a rant for another time. It also happened in Europe. Fellini with Casanova and Visconti with 1900.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Another film that, this is another one. Sutherland wanted to work with directors that he found interesting. So he would play the character. We're not kidding, friends. His character name was Homer Simpson in the 1975 film The Day of the Locust, which I think they made fun of. If you were one that saw Babylon last year, this is that cinematic father.
Yep.
To capture the decadence of Hollywood and show business and a seedy underbelly back in the 1930s, if I remember correctly.
Locust, Day of the Locust is actually it's not on my list, but I'll just say really quickly that other than Mick from Rocky being in the movie, it's a movie
that nomination for that too.
Yeah, dude, I've wanted to watch this for forever because I actually like Schlesinger, the director.
Yeah,
but I've never gotten around to this one, so that's cool.
It's on Arrow Home Video. It's worth checking out. But yeah, you will want to watch The Simpsons to cleanse your palate afterwards. I misspoke earlier. Bertolucci directed 1900.
Where, yeah. That's what I thought, but I thought maybe I was mistaken. Yeah.
No. By the way, if you think about it, Sutherland's characters in both those films, really bad endings to them. Really bad. I'm just going to leave it at that. There is one film I do want to bring up that means a lot to me with Sutherland, and it's his Mr. Bennet in Joe Wright's Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah, I still haven't seen that. I've not went through a Joe Wright thing, and I just haven't had a reason. Okay. But when I saw that, when he died, I was like, I want to watch Pride and Prejudice now.
Okay, so first off, I know Joe Wright's Pride and Prejudice is not the miniseries from the 90s. I know we all can't be Colin Firth coming out of the water. I get that. That being said, Joe Wright's Pride and Prejudice, which is about 2 hours long, is a great Jane Austen 101. Keira Knightley, Carey Mulligan, Rosamund Pike, Donald Sutherland, Matthew McFadden for you fans of Succession, Brenda Blethyn is are the parents. And there has always been a kind of the typical Austenian older male, like Mr. Bennett. Now, I have to say, growing in my household, I have said for years and years and years, it's a Jane Austen world. And I'm just the dad. I'm just Mr. Bennett. I just want my pipe and my dog and my paper and my corner and leave me alone. And that's kind of like the Austenian dads. Sutherland, when you watch this, because I know you will, when Keira Knightley finally comes and says that she is in love and can she have her father's blessing, and to see Mr. Bennett show emotion is amazing. And yep. And really, really hits hard to, you know, to us dads who show emotion. Yep. So definitely add that to your list. And that's another one of just Sutherland going, yeah, I want to do this. I want to be in this. The other thing I thought of with his, I think if not his very final moment, but near to his second to last moment in the Hunger Games, is when, and spoiler alert on Mockingjay Part 2, whatever.
Let's go ahead.
But when Julianne Moore gets killed, he laughs. He just, it looks like spontaneous laughter before his character dies.
Hilarious.
That's just a great acting choice.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, it's, man, he's just, the more and more, and I've been thinking about him a lot as I've been writing notes and stuff, but he's just a special guy.
Another one is, he has like, I think it's two scenes in Backdraft.
Yep, he does.
So
he's like the dad of the brothers, right?
No, he's the convicted arsonist.
Well, another movie I haven't seen in probably 25 years.
I saw it in college, but that was the first one. After Silence of the Lambs, we got a lot of crime thriller dramas in which we had distinguished actors getting to be stuck in a cell playing a killer. Ed Harris and Just Cause comes to mind. Sutherland might have been the first. I think Backdraft came like a year after Silence of the Lambs. But there's a nice two-person scene with De Niro and Sutherland, because De Niro plays the fire chief, and he's up. Sutherland's character is up for parole, but there's a great moment of. I go back to the Anderson Cooper interview on 60 Minutes. Cooper says, you know, you've played a lot of unlikable characters. And he goes, yeah, but I find the likability in them. And he goes, even Backdraft, and Sutherland covers his mouth and just starts giggling. Because that's the actor's job.
Yeah. I mean, hold on. This is going to stick with me though. So Kurt Russell and Billy Baldwin were the sons of, is it Scott Glenn's character?
I thought Glenn was a fellow firefighter. Yeah, careful with cinematic gene pools.
I know.
Apparently John Voight and Helen Mirren made Nicolas Cage, and I don't want to see that ever.
Hilarious. I don't want to see that. It's been so long since I've seen it, I almost don't even feel like I should say I've seen it. I just remember certain scenes, and I remember where I saw it. But I don't remember that movie.
Apparently, it's minor Ron Howard. I don't know. I'm kidding, so, Ron. I don't rank.
That's hilarious. He's ranking. I have two movies I just want to bring up because we've already brought them up. So I'm just going to kind of jump through them real quick because MASH obviously is one of mine. I just want to say that like I went through a massive Robert Altman phase. I feel like I still am always. Yeah, I'm always in a Robert Altman phase. Much like Woody Allen, who is a far more controversial subject, but his movies, no matter if it's good or bad, his really terrible ones, his good ones, especially through the 90s and before, I can kind of just watch them no matter what. Like, they're endlessly amusing to me, even if I think they're horseshit.
A Robert Altman misfire is better than a lot of directors' big swing for the fences. I get it. I know.
Yeah. So, that's exactly it. Is like Robert Altman is like that for me as well, where it's like I watch them all and I just love that kind of. It almost feels improvised. Everyone's speaking over each other. You know, like that whole thing, man. It could be. Any of them, but MASH is the one that I saw. It was not my first Altman at all.
What was your first Altman?
I think my first Altman was probably, I don't know why I'm like spacing that right now. Help me with movies that I can't the think player, of right now.
Shortcuts, Popeye, Secret Honor, Fool for Love. God damn, dude. Vincent and Theo, Nashville, Countdown. Good Lord, dude. Shortcuts? Fred Aporte?
No, I know. Hold on. I just pulled it up.
Miller? You're just making me do this. Brewster McCloud. No. Thieves Like Us. Nope. Quintet, OC and Stigs. A Wedding, Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean.
I forgot Three Women, but it's cool. No, actually, funny enough, my first one was Gosford Park.
Oh, you mean
way later. Got it at Maddie's a Blockbuster. Parents. Yeah, got it at a Blockbuster that my buddy bought it in the used section and we watched it together. So yeah.
The child of Upstairs, Downstairs, and the parents of Downton Abbey. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah. I also watched Tanner or on Tanner when it was on Criterion. Or Tanner 88, rather, sorry. And then but then I got really into it, and MASH I actually saw in school in Gehring's class, I believe. Or we definitely watched Catch 22, and I think that made me want to watch MASH, but I can't remember how it worked. But that's I saw McCabe good. And Mrs. Miller. Long Goodbye is
love Long
my
Goodbye.
Personal
yeah.
favorite. Altman. Like, I just love that yep. movie. So it's great. All that to say, it's so nice to see someone like Sutherland and Gould, especially with them working with each other in something like MASH, because before Altman becomes like Altman, you know what I'm saying? He makes MASH now, and you have these powerhouses.
But they were not crazy about Altman initially. So there is that. First off, you also mentioned Dr. Wes Gehring. We love you, sir. Hope to see you again soon.
Yeah.
Big influence. But yeah, the whole thing, and for those who don't know, is Altman would have these long takes where he would mic his actors. Everybody was mic'd. Yep. And like the great example are the mess hall scenes and the operating room scenes in MASH. Everybody had to be on. Actors loved working with Altman because they had that chance. He would say action, you'd operate, you'd be in a mess hall, and you'd carry on a conversation or you do your business, and the camera would just go because you didn't know when the camera was going to cross paths with you. Well, that's why he had that big stuff like A Wedding, like Gosford Park, like McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Yep. Yeah. I think of it kind of like the way that William Friedkin described action in the French Connection, where
by not getting a permit for anything.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he basically never told the camera person what the blocking was going to be. So they had to find the action. You know what I mean?
And to a certain degree, Eastwood never said action or cut. Because when he was starting out, if somebody yelled action and cut with a megaphone, it'd scare the horses. So just go ahead. And I actually, as a director of plays, I've done that. I've just said, go ahead.
Yeah.
And then go, oh, that's enough for now.
Yeah. I like to go, action! Like really loud.
Yeah, you also have a monocle and a megaphone, and you have equestrian pants and a beret. Eric von Stroheim.
You also
answer Madam's fan mail and show movies of her for young William Holden. I know what you do.
I will tell you this real quick before I move on to Clute real quick is wrestling aside real quick. There's a wrestler by the name of Timeless Toni Storm right now in AEW, and her whole gimmick when she comes on the screen, it goes black and white. And everything.
Is in the Norma Desmond?
100%.
Get out.
There is a wrestling gimmick that is Norma Desmond, and she is so over with everyone.
What is her name again?
Timeless Toni Storm. She is the world champ right now. And she is.
I have to look this up. You're making me watch modern wrestling. I don't know about this. She's
hilarious and awesome. I was able to see her live too. She's great. So, anyways,
you bring this up. So, it's my obligatory time. I wish there was a buddy cop film in 1975 starring Dusty Rhodes and Ernie the Cat Ladd.
We said
before 48 hours, it had been Dusty and the Big Cat, you egg sucking dog.
That's so funny.
Anyway, I'm glad it took us this long before we got into wrestling.
I know, right? Yeah, I'm gonna get us back on the rails real quick because
yes, sir.
Clute is a movie that I Actually, let me say this before I jump into Clute. You brought up, well, it's because I'm being mindful of time, because like we have a limited time here that we can record, and I'm trying to do that, but I'm forgetting to talk about things you say. So you talked about Nicholas Rogue's Don't Look Now. I watched that movie in the mid to late 2000s probably, and I'll be honest, man, that movie bored the shit out of me. But I'm like, every time I see clips and stuff from it now, I'm like, I have to rewatch it. It's like your theory that you told me. You got to rewatch stuff every 5 to 10 years, right? And yes. I feel like I'm finally ready for that movie. I'm excited to rewatch it now.
That film is famous for what is kind of known as the scene. If you go in the film folklore, and both of them have said, no, we don't actually do it. It's just shot that way. But for a long, long time, before there was the internet, there were these underground discussions that Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland actually did the deed on camera. If that was the case, kind of like the dude from the director of Cannibal Holocaust getting arrested in Italy, something like that would have happened. And yes, I brought up Cannibal Holocaust on a Donald Sutherland episode. Your pledge dollars at work.
Actually, not the first time that movie's been brought up on the podcast, unfortunately.
I know, I listened.
But no,
I would say give Don't Look Now another chance. It just got re-released on Blu-ray and Criterion, and it's worth checking out.
Yeah, it's on channel right now too, so I thought about checking it out. I actually have, and this is for after we record, message me some Nicholas Rogue titles, because all the ones I've seen I have not liked, but I saw all of them like 15 years or more ago. So he is just someone I need to like revisit, because I feel like I just didn't get him. I was in undergrad and college when I watched these, and I just don't think I got it. So
It's absolutely okay. It happens.
Yeah. So I would love to hear about your favorites. But let me say this. Clute, I want to say my favorite thing is, one, again, going back to Sutherland being a dominant performer, what a subtle performance in my memory, while also being able to play off of Jane Fonda, where he doesn't like steal the show from her, while at the same time just really being that, I'm going to use the phrase again, commanding presence in this movie. Not to mention the cinematographer who did The Godfather and stuff did this movie, if I'm not mistaken.
The Prince of Darkness, Gordon Willis.
And this movie looks fucking amazing.
It does. Also, the thing is, this is a year after MASH. So for him to go from Hawkeye Pierce, who was, for a lot of people, me one of them, the anti-establishment movie star hero, to this straight-laced police detective who's trying to do his job. He's dodging all of Bree's advances upon him. He just wants to work the case. You know, that's really good range. And I mean, that's within a year. I think of the year that a lot of people have discovered Daniel Day-Lewis, where he was Lord, I'm exaggerating, but he plays Lord Foppington in A Room with a View, and then a gay punk in My Beautiful Laundrette, both in 1985.
Yeah.
Is this the same dude? And that was kind of like that with Sutherland.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, he was also Christ the same year. So
I mean, bought Clute really... for my kid on Blu-ray. That's the kind of cinema dad I am.
The Criterion one or no?
You're damn right, the Criterion. Yeah. By the way, apparently at the time of this recording, there's a certain store, there's a certain chain in this town. I think it rhymes with Yarns and Noble. That is doing Criterion's 50% off.
Are they doing that right now? How did I not see that anywhere?
Because tomorrow I'm going to pick up Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid from Sam Peckinpah. I will await your invitation to discuss that one.
I want to do a Peckinpah thing regardless. We got to do it together because we didn't get a chance with Straw Dogs. So we're going to do it. The last thing I want to say just real quick, just briefly, is Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I just want to give a little history with this movie, which probably won't be that surprising to you since you've been listening to some of our old episodes. But the horror genre was not my favorite genre.
Keep going.
Yeah. Horror has never been, nor was it, my favorite genre. Whenever I was, working through my love of film and then going to school, most of the horror movies I had seen were not great. And even if I thought that they were good, looking back, I'm like, man, those are pretty subpar. I really should have watched the classics, but I just had no interest in slashers. I was not interested. At the time, I'd never seen the first Halloween. I'd never seen...
Sure.
I may have seen the first Freddy. I'd seen a bunch of Friday the 13th on Friday the 13th on TV with friends. You know, yeah. Stuff like that. But I just wasn't a fan. And I challenged myself because it's like whenever I wasn't as big a fan as everyone else of... I'm missing it. It's... It's the James Bond, the 23rd James Bond movie. The third of the new ones. Skyfall.
Spectre.
Skyfall. So I remember I wasn't as big a fan of Skyfall as like literally everyone, especially the Bond fans. Not that I disliked it per se, but I just wasn't a fan really. But I hadn't seen like any Bond movies other than like Pierce Brosnan or something.
Problem.
Everybody was like giving me so much shit. So guess what I did? I watched every Bond movie, including Never Say Never Again. And then I had the exact same fucking feeling. Okay. So, and the thing with horror was that I would talk about how I wasn't a big fan. And then people would say, well, have you watched this? Have you watched The Exorcist? Have you watched whatever? And I was like, well, no, but I'm just not a big fan. So I made it my like fucking cinephile duty in like 2010 and 2011 to just start marathoning horror movies. And I watched yes. every classic I could. I watched a bunch of just really schlocky horror, like Reanimator and, you know, all of that stuff. Yeah. And I became a huge fan. But one of the really pivotal movies for me was Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I actually really, really love it. And it's one of the movies that brought me into horror. Yeah. And the actor I remember from that movie is Sutherland. Honestly, I probably couldn't tell you any other actors in it off the top of my head. That's how
Leonard Nimoy, Brooke Adams.
Completely forgot Nimoy was in this.
Robert Duvall has one scene. Yeah, no, sorry. Jeff Goldblum has a scene in it. Veronica Cartwright. For you fans of Lost in Space. So I mentioned earlier about seeing this. I saw Jaws in the theaters with my dad. That's 1975. I was five. Scared the hell out of me. We were in Long Beach Island, New Jersey. And then the next day we were on the beach. My father, a surgeon, a man whose job is to heal people and a devout Catholic, picked me up over his head, hummed two notes and marched toward the water and scared the living shit out of me. And that probably was my start of love of film. The fact that, you know, a piece of celluloid did that.
Yeah.
3 years later, I watched Halloween in the theater. My dad was great with my dad and my brother, who was 6 years older. And I'm watching it like this with the fingers over the eyes. And I don't remember this from Jaws, but I do remember from Halloween. There was an equal amount of laughter and screams. And of course I'm like, why are they laughing? This isn't funny. I don't get this. So I knew that Jaws was PG. Rating system is flawed. But as I mentioned with Channel 100, because Invasion of the Body Snatchers was rated PG, it was on a lot. And that, I think it wasn't a horror monster. It wasn't a cartoon. It wasn't a killer sure. shark. It wasn't a maskless killer. It was everybody could turn against you.
Yep.
That's some heavy shit when you're 7 or 8.
I mean, a precursor is like the thing. Where, like, there's an alien that can become anything,
right? I had not seen Don Siegel's version of The Thing, and the, you know, Carpenter version came out when I was 12. And I wrote this, I believe I wrote this for the Yap, for the Film Yap years ago, but I now consider Taxi Driver a horror film.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw that film on, well, we had the originally network broadcast from 1977. So I was about 7 years old. And the reason why that's a horror film is that Travis Bickle is next to you at your bar stool right now. And all the stuff we said about King of Comedy and Joker. Yeah. Taxi Driver should get a percentage of the gross of Joker. But because that's a dude right there. It's not a massless killer. It's not a monster. It's a dude sitting next to me right now who won't shut up about why the government is fucked up.
Yeah, I actually did. I went to a conference actually talking about how that film is about PTSD.
I got to see the 20th anniversary of it in Chicago at the Music Box Theater. and it was a full house, and it was almost all men. And it was awesome in a different way until I heard a fraction of the audience cheering the first time you see Travis with a mohawk. And I'm like, I'm going home.
Yeah. It was like whenever I saw, dude, I don't know what's wrong with my brain today. I can't think of any of the movies that I want to talk about. What is the movie? What is the 2012 movie about by Catherine Bigelow? The
Hurt Locker?
Nope.
Zero Dark Thirty.
So I had a press screening for that movie. So, but it was an audi like a it was a public press screening. So the audience, like the public, was able to
cheer.
Well, dude. Yeah. Whenever, let's just say, it was rough and it affected my experience of that movie. it was
I'm sorry, in wrapping things up, there's a couple of films I do want to mention from Sutherland.
Please, yeah, finish this out. Go ahead.
Eye of the Needle from 1981, where he is he's a possible bad guy teamed up and having a romance with Kate Nelligan, and which is a really good popcorn movie, The Great Train Robbery. He's teamed up with Sean Connery and Leslie Ann Down. It's directed by Michael Crichton. Don't let the mustaches and the steam stove top hats fool you. It's a fun heist film. So let the mustaches
destroy you, actually.
Yes, exactly. Add those to your Sutherland watch list, friends.
Yeah. And Crichton is quite a character. So you should just watch
behind the camera, just kind of wow, you did this. Yeah. And there's a part of me that feels like, did you do this so you could write more of your books? Now I sound like a parent. Did you direct a Burt Reynolds movie called Physical Evidence so you could finish Jurassic Park?
I know,
did
right?
You? I'm just wondering. Now I'm old. So I'm on funny. The front porch. I'm like, can you make money on YouTube? How do you do that?
While yelling at people to get off your lawn.
I'm really in the clouds now that I watched The King of Comedy tonight.
That's hilarious. No, I'm really glad that you had reached out to me about this, because for listeners,
means Matt, a lot, man. He's a great dude.
Yeah, Matt sent me a message and was just like, "Hey, you doing a memorial episode for Donald Sutherland?" And I, quite frankly, I had so much planned that I hadn't thought of it. And when you said it, I was like, "I'm going to make time for that. That sounds awesome." And so I'm really glad that we did this.
I also wish I could find out what voiceover jobs, like the orange juice commercial, paid him more than certain films he worked on. You mentioned Sir Ian McKellen, who said on Fresh Air, he made more money doing the Harry Potter video game, he made more money doing the Lord of the Rings video game than he actually did doing Lord of the Rings.
Not surprised.
It's probably not surprising. So anyway, Donald, we love you. You are with us always cinematically. That's badass. And hopefully, eventually, time will pass and Kiefer will play you in some historical biopic.
Oh,
maybe not the Donald Sutherland story, but he'll show up in a scene as Donald. You know,
yeah.
Why not?
I love that. I love that.
Maybe there'll be, and go Expos, says the Tigers fan.
Listeners, whether you agree or disagree with how we feel about these movies, go watch a Donald Sutherland movie in memory of the great actor. Hopefully we've given you a lot of titles. So go look into some of them. See what you think. Matt, as always, thank you so much for being on here, buddy.
Film sociology at WFYI.org. Thanks for listening.
Yes, yes. Go listen to Matt. I can't believe I forgot that. Go listen to Film Sociology. Also, follow Matt on social media so you can give him movies that you've watched over the last week.
Thank you.
Anyways, thanks a lot, Matt.
Yep, you bet.
All right, that was my little chat about Donald Sutherland, my memorial episode, so to speak, with Matthew Soucy. Go check out Film Sociology. Honestly, he's a really fun guy, if you can't already tell. And also, I gave you my thoughts on the new Costner film, Horizon, an American Saga, Chapter 1. I gave you the Nichols movie, The Bike Riders, and talked a little bit about Ty West's Maxine. So I hope, again, if you have any thoughts on that, please let me know. MediumCoolPod on Instagram or MediumCoolPod@gmail.com. You can email me and let me know. That said, let's talk a little bit about what's coming out this Friday. First off, Maxine came out, I think, last Friday, so definitely go check that out. Coming out this Friday, we have Fly Me to the Moon. The Lion King is being re-released. We also have the very anticipated horror film Long Legs. Very excited to check that out, as well as the new A24 film Sing Sing. I think it's starring Colton Domingo, if I'm not mistaken. So go check that. Coleman Domingo. I said the wrong name. I've said the wrong names all day, clearly. So, I'm not going to go into that right now. Anyway, so go check those movies out. I'm going to check some of them out. I know I'm going to see Long Legs. I hope to see Sing Sing here soon. So all that said, thank you so much for listening. And as always, everyone, good night, good luck, and take it easy.